Well, hello there, and welcome to Bikescape, episode number 56, and it is January 18th, 2007.
Quand on partait de bon matin, quand on partait sur les chemins, à bicyclette, nous étions quelques bons copains. Il y avait Fernand, il y avait Firmin, il y avait Francis et Sébastien, et puis Paulette. On était tous amoureux d'elle, on se sentait pousser les ailes, à bicyclette. Sur les petits chemins de terre, on a souvent vécu l'enfer, pour ne pas mettre pied à terre devant Paulette.
Well, we're off and pedaling on another Bikescape, number 56. Welcome, everybody. If you've been a long-time listener of Bikescape, you probably know that I tend to focus this show on urban cycling, and my idea of a really great bike ride is Market Street, which is the main street in San Francisco, Market Street at rush hour, just dodging taxi doors, squeezing in between buses, hopping over streetcar tracks, on a fixed gear if possible. That makes it even better, and I don't know, it's just I'm crazy, but that's what I love. And one day I'll be very sad when everything is safe in the city and we have bike lanes everywhere, and I'll feel like the golden age of cycling is over, even though that's what I'm working towards. But one day, a month or so ago, I did load my bike onto a BART train and headed out to the suburbs, where some really nice touring happens. Headed out to Walnut Creek, which is the home of Rivendell Bicycles. And I was lucky, I just kind of dropped in, and I had my microphone with me, and I ran into Grant Peterson, who's the owner of the place. And I got a nice interview with someone who has a sort of an old-fashioned, kind of refreshing attitude about cycling in general. And he builds bikes that are just an amazing work of art. Just exquisite steel lugged frames and beautiful little touches, just right to the shellac on the handlebars, the shellac tape on the handlebars, and just beautiful bikes. Anyway, let's go to the interview. We'll sit down and talk to Grant for a while. So we're here with Grant Peterson of the Rivendell Bicycle Works in Walnut Creek, California. If you're not familiar with the Rivendell bicycles, they're all custom fitted mostly. And why don't you tell me about what makes Rivendell different from all the other Specialized and Treks and everything else that you see in the normal bicycle stores?
They have lugs. That's the main thing. Not all of them are custom made. The Rivendell brand is custom made, but then we have a lot of bikes that aren't custom made for the rider, but they all have lugs, and they're all handmade lugged bicycles that we
steal.
And they're all steel, lugged steel bikes. That's all we do.
So the lugs are beautiful. They're not just like your usual lugs. They have beautiful little curlicues and windows in them. And what's the attraction? Why would somebody want to have a lug steel frame?
They aren't just beautiful. I mean, I think going back 30 years ago, when almost all bikes were lugged, you know, there were a range of lugs and a variety of lugs. Some were simple, some were fancy. And then lugs went out of fashion, and I think it just made more sense as we were starting a company that did only lug frames to do beautiful lugs that people would like to look at. And I think if it were still a lugged world, then there would be room for a range of lugs. But I mean, in anything you get, you want it to be nice looking, you want it to work well, and you want it to look nice also. And the other part of the question was, what is an advantage of a lug or something?
Yeah, why?
Well, lugs, the question has to sort of address what is the advantage of steel also.
Because that's the next question, but we'll combine them.
Okay. Well, steel is the best material for bicycle frames. It's the most practical, the safest, and the best. And I know, you know, these days people will hear that and scoff at that or think that I'm just crazy for saying it. Because there's this notion that anything that's familiar has to be archaic, nostalgic, low-tech, old-fashioned, something like that. But the fact is that, you know, the best chairs are made of wood.
Mm-hmm.
The best shoes are probably made of leather. And the best bicycle frames are made of steel. And it's easy to qualify that. It's easy to explain. And I think to understand why that's the case. There's a notion out there that performance is in materials, and this is a notion that is battered into us constantly. You know what I mean? There's performance fabrics. You know, there's, you know, you have you know, DuPont and Malden Mills, you know, taking credit for people climbing to the summit of the highest peaks in the world, you know, but they did it in our fabrics, you know, so we are part of their victory. And the same thing happens in bicycles. You know, there's a notion that there are performance materials. And I guess if you define performance a certain way, you know, you can assign attributes to the material and say these are high performance attributes, and you can say, well, it's lightweight or it's strong.
They build fighter jets out of it.
Build fighter jets out of it. And right now we are living in times where technology is so infused into everything we do and everything we read about and so much a part of our lives that people are sort of wired to warm up to anything that has a high-tech image or a high-tech sound to it, whether it's titanium or carbon fiber or something like that. But when you get down to a bicycle frame, you have to realize that a bicycle doesn't go anywhere by itself. You can buy true performance if you call performance things like speed or something, and we seem to be speed obsessed these days in bicycles. You can buy that in a car, in an engine, you know, by having a bigger engine or a motorcycle or a jet ski boat or something like that. But a bicycle, people seem to like to forget that they are the engine. And you wouldn't consider a car high performance if it didn't have an engine. And yet people consider bikes high performance when they don't have an engine. Right. You are the engine, so you make the bike perform however you do it, whether you are going down a twisty road at a higher speed than somebody else, if that's what you're into, if that's what you like to do. You, to a certain extent, it's true that slight variations in the frame geometry or little details of the frame may make that a little bit easier than it would be on another frame, but it's just splitting hairs. Mm-hmm. You know, a good descender is going to out-descend a bad descender, even if the bad descender is on a bike that is much higher performance or is designed for going around corners faster. So, you know, people, it's comforting to believe that you can buy a high-performance bicycle, that you have enough money and you can buy this performance. And in most things in your life, you can. You can buy tools and machinery and technology that, you know, that are high-performance. And I don't even need to list examples. There are just too many. It's hard to think of something that isn't an example of that these days. But a bicycle is not an example of that. And that's not...
That's the beauty of a bicycle, isn't it?
Yeah, they are simple, and you know,
you
do provide the performance. And going back to steel, is that steel is a safer material because, well, when you look at the materials for a bicycle frame and you look at the qualities that are important and the qualities that ought to be desirable in a bicycle frame, you have to, one thing that is basic to any of this is safety. You want a bicycle to be safe. And how does a material contribute to safety? Well, one of the ways it contributes is its toughness. Now, toughness is a word that everyone knows the word tough, but in terms of materials and structures, toughness means specifically the ability for a material to slow the propagation of a crack. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that it'll bend rather than break suddenly.
Right. Which aluminum will do.
Aluminum will do, and a lot of the other materials tend to fail much more quickly than steel does. A good example is like regular plate glass has an ultimate tensile strength 5 times greater than chrome moly steel does. Mm. It's around 500,000 PSI, pounds per square inch of tensile strength. But glass does not fail in tension. It doesn't fail when you pull it apart. It fails because it's not tough. It's brittle. A crack zips right through it. And so it shatters, you know. So you don't think of glass as being strong, and yet it's 5 times stronger than steel. But you know that it fails suddenly, and a lot of frame materials fail suddenly too. And steel doesn't. Steel is the toughest frame material. It doesn't snap. It doesn't break off suddenly. It doesn't fail catastrophically. It bends. It dents. And if it bends in an accident, you can usually bend it back. Right. You can use a stick or a rock or some other sort of tool out there that you find, and you can bend it back. And it may not ride the same way on your ride back home, but you can ride it back home. And that's not to say that steel frames can't break, but they absolutely give you warning. Whether you heed the warnings or are paying attention is another, I guess that's another topic. But steel has the best and the safest failure mode of any frame material out there. And
it lasts longer. So a 30-year-old bike, you can always fix it up to an antique bike and you can make it work just as well as a brand new bike.
Every bit as well, and 30-year-old steel bikes are out there by the tens of thousands now, and they're still being ridden in this country and in other countries. So steel is a really good, strong, safe material.
So I'm just kind of backing into this interview by starting with the technical aspect with the lugs and the steel, but why? I understand why you use steel and why you use lugs, but the basic idea of your bike seemed to be kind of old-fashioned. You don't see threadless headsets. It's all kind of what era are you looking at when you think of the classic bike that you're trying to build here?
Well, I don't really know what era. You know, we aren't trying to copy bikes from any era. There are times in the evolution of anything, bicycles or cars or anything else, where sort of a design ethic and materials and aesthetic seem to converge all at the same time and reach, you know, their zenith, and everything is really wonderful and good. And for bicycles, I mean, there have been vast improvements, true improvements since the 70s, but in many ways the 70s were a time of no-nonsense bicycles. And the 70s, probably the late 70s, you know, when people started touring has always had a good influence on bicycles. I think a much better influence than racing has, because a touring bicycle is a practical tool and it has a job to perform. It has to last, it has to carry weight well, it has to ride well as it's carrying weight, and it has to get you through, you know, long rides day after day in all weather, blah, blah, blah. And when when bicycles were sort of based on touring bicycles, then, you know, they became kind of practical. You know, there were ways to put fenders on them. You could put fenders on them. You could put racks on them, and you could make them really usable, beautiful things to ride. I'm sure someone will hear this and think they know where it's going and call me a curmudgeon as though that's a bad thing, you know, because those are kind of funny things to be called and to read about, and people like to put labels on people. One of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately and just observing is that the decline of the bicycle, yeah, I guess that's why I brought up the whole term about curmudgeon, because I don't want to be one of these guys that looks back and says, well, things were so much better way back then. I know there have been many improvements. I recognize them. I certainly take advantage of them, you know, whenever they are real improvements, and I embrace them, you know, when they seem to make sense. But going back to the decline of the modern bicycle, I think a lot of it had to do with the rise of racing and the popularity of racing in the United States. Bicycles were, if you were to go into any bike shop, if you were to go into a time machine and go back into any bike shop that was around in the late 70s and look at a road bike, you would see a bike. You could be a blind person, walk in there, put your hand on a bike, and then just ask the question, can this bike take a tire that's 32 millimeters wide? Can this bike take a fender? Can I put a rack on this bike? And the answers would be yes, 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 of course. And that's really rare these days. And I think things have declined just from that point of view, from that sort of practical design point of view, with the popularity of racing. Because now that racing started to get popular in the 80s, and tourists were seen as sort of nerdy, backwards plaid-wearing people, as though that was a bad thing. And sort of the timing of racing and the flash of racing and the high-tech influence from other industries and
Lycra.
Lycra, and you know, and suddenly you have a whole population of people approaching middle age, and you know, even in their late 30s, you know, who want to become fit and want to become healthy, and bicycles are a great way to do that, of course. And then they go and they're caught up in racing and in the hype of racing and in looking,
dressing to ride
and dressing to ride. And that's probably my favorite topic these days, is how bicycle riders dress. And I hope we get a chance to talk about
that.
Let's
talk about that now.
Okay.
Because you do have a selection of clothing.
Well, first, let me go on about racing bikes. Racing bikes are really impractical bikes. People don't drive cars like NASCAR drivers
right,
do,
yes,
but people do ride bikes that way. Mm-hmm. And they're bikes that can't take a tire bigger than 28 millimeters, mm-hmm. can't take a fender. They're super light and super impractical for anything other than racing. The fact that that you can go out and have fun on them and go on a nice, you know, 80-mile hilly ride and come back feeling great and invigorated, that does not change the fact that the bikes are a broken spoke away from being unrideable because
right.
the clearances are so small. Mm-hmm. That does not change the fact that if it rains or the road is wet, you're going to get sprayed and you're going to spray anyone near you mm-hmm. on the bicycle because there's no way to put a fender on it. Okay, clothing.
Oh, okay, yes. So you don't sell any Lycra here, do you?
No.
You have a whole line of clothing.
Yeah.
And what's your favorite material?
Well, I like wool clothing I guess that would be our high performance clothing. And then for riding in hot weather, just, you know, either really lightweight wool or just cotton. One of the things that I think racing has also brought to the table is a just it's that funny look, the really tight, garish, multi-logoed jersey look. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to think that, you know, people have ridden bikes for 150 years, and, you know, there have been sort of accepted bicycle attire for recreational riding, even back in the 1800s, you know, there was that. But these days, there seems to be a whole lot of people who dress and look like racers, and I think they're oversold on the benefits of aerodynamics and tight clothing and padded chamois and click-in shoes. And the thing that I guess bothers me about that is the message that it sends to people who don't ride bikes but would otherwise like to ride a bike.
It puts it out of reach. It makes it seem like a sport that unattainable physical
That's level. Exactly yeah. what it does. It mm-hmm. makes it seem like, well, I can't get a bike. I have to be a sporty looking guy, you know, or I have to dress like that. And no matter how you dress, everyone likes the clothes they wear, and they are not necessarily willing to change their whole persona just to ride a bike. And they're told that they sort of have to. Right. And even with clipless pedals, you know, the idea that, you know, you can't just get on a bike and pedal it away.
Right.
You have to get a specific shoe that clicks in.
I've been sold on that, but it's one of the. I understand that the limits. You can go. You can. It's not black and white, but you can go so far, and then you realize you've gone over. You can't walk down the street anymore.
Yeah,
you can't go for a walk with your girlfriend on a date.
You can't run up the stairs mm-hmm. to catch the BART train. Mm-hmm. You know. And I know that there are shoes and sandals with recessed cleats that make it easier. But just, you know, overall, the message, and it's not a vague message at all, but the message that a new would-be rider gets when he or she goes into a store and says, I want to get a nice bike and start riding, mm-hmm. is that, well, you've got to get the clothing for it too, because you'll get a sore crotch without the right shorts, mm-hmm. and you'll catch too much wind without the right top, and you'll risk your eyes without the right sunglasses, and you'll be inefficient without the right shoes.
And you'll have to change your clothes when you get to work.
And you'll have to change your clothes when you get to work. And if, you know, just suiting up to go for a bicycle ride, if it takes you 5 minutes to dress, You aren't going to think it's worth it for a 10-minute ride, and so you won't go for a 10-minute ride. And 10-minute rides are great mm-hmm. if they're just around the neighborhood. It's a great ride. They also grow into 15-minute rides. But if your whole approach to bicycle riding is suiting up, dressing like somebody that you don't feel like, and then going out and punishing yourself for the benefit of your health or cardiovascular system right. or something, It's so contrary to what bicycle riding, you know, can be, and it sort of short circuits. It's not going to be something that you do 30 years from now if every time you do it you have to dress like a right. clown and hurt yourself.
Yeah. So you do sell clothes that are considered bicycle clothes,
yeah.
but they're not covered with logos. They're mainly made of wool or maybe some cotton, I'm not sure. And
yeah.
They're classic styles. Like once again, we're into the classic style of maybe old jerseys, old style wool jerseys, and you know the stripes. And you could wear them to work.
You could wear them to work. The clothing that I'm wearing right now is what I ride a bike in. Mm-hmm. I've got my sandals, Tiva sandals. Uh-huh. I've got wool socks. They happen to be cycling socks, but they're 80% wool. I've got long woven nylon pants with a seamless crotch in them.
Yeah, little gusset in there.
Little gusset yeah. and Velcro at the bottom just to take it out of the greasy chain.
Uh-huh.
And they're big enough in the thigh. And then I have a...
Are those made here? Are those?
Yeah. I'm not even going to list the brand, but they are made here. And the brand says that they're made... This stands for made... in the USA. Uh-huh. So they're made in the USA.
And not Italian.
And then the seersucker shirt that I've got on, it's a long sleeve seersucker shirt. I remember back in the 80s, there's a local writer, and he's still a friend and a writer. His name is Eric House, and he was one of the best writers around, and he won the Terrible Two 1 year, and he wore a long-sleeve, buttoned-up, blue Oxford cloth shirt for all of his writing. At the time, he didn't own a jersey. And I and many other people tried to sort of introduce him to clothing. You know, you sort of want to take this diamond in the rough and help them get even better. And, you know, everyone wants to do that to people. And he wouldn't have any of it, you know. He said, no, the shirt works great. You know, it keeps the sun off my arms, off my skin, and it flaps in the wind and cools me down a little bit. And, you know, there's no hot Lycra getting warmed by the sun and pressing on my skin. And, you know, he wasn't trying to convince me. He was just trying to say, lay off, I know what I like. And, you know, it really made an impression on me. And so I've sort of come over that way. So this guy named Eric House is my influence in that way. And the seersucker is just, it's crinkly fabric. It doesn't lay on your skin. So it's really comfortable. And
so what other ways, what other little branches of the business are there? Rivendell also publishes a lot of opinion pieces, and you have a newsletter. And
yeah, we have a newsletter.
You have a whole raft of PDFs you can download.
So we have our own publication also. It's sort of a magazine newsletter.
It's nice. It kind of empowers people to think of their bikes as something they can fix themselves. And
yeah, that's part of the philosophy. It doesn't have any advertising in it, and we don't cover racing, and we don't have recipes or really any personal growth kind of stories. But we try to make it really just interesting and useful to someone who's, you know, we have some good interviews in there too. We've interviewed lots of interesting people in it. Yeah.
So what am I missing? What's the obvious question I should be asking?
Oh, well, I don't know. You know, we have lugged steel frames, and that's the only kind of frame that we do. And we have them to fit short people, and they go up to 68 centimeters. So we have them to fit really tall people too. I'm not trying to turn this into a commercial break or anything.
Oh, that's okay.
You know, but you know, we have 7 different models, and we've got a website, and we don't cater to racers. They're beautiful bikes. They are not inexpensive. You know, they aren't. You know, everyone would like this really smart, beautiful, practical bike. You know, to cost $500. You know, and they don't. You know, they start at about $1,400 and probably average around $2,500, $2,700. So they're expensive bikes, but
we've been doing it for about 15 years now, haven't you?
Yeah, well, going on 13.
Yeah. So it's, if you were to go to some kind of bicycle consultant and say, this is the kind of business I want to start, wouldn't he laugh at you?
Yeah.
It sounds like suicide.
It does.
How did you manage to keep it up for 13 years?
Well, it's we don't have a whole lot of competition doing it, you know, and I think it would have been, as a small company, it would have been certainly suicide to try to compete with bigger companies. You know, if starting out as a small business, you know, you don't pick your adversaries as, you know, Trek and Specialized and Giant, and you don't pick the biggest companies in the world to go head to head with, and that means you don't make bikes the way they're making bikes, and you don't market them the way they're marketing them. You can never outsource them, outprice them, outdeliver them, or you can never give payment terms as generous as they can give dealers. They will beat you on every single possible front. They will just cream you. And so here we are doing something different. We're doing bikes that they don't build and they don't want to build, because with their volumes, they have to follow the trends, right, and they have to look at the cost of manufacturing, because a low cost of manufacturing and a high selling price gives you room to promote. And if you have high manufacturing costs and you still have to sell at reasonable prices, there's no room to promote. And so they aren't really interested in that. They don't feel threatened by us. And they see this as a tiny little charming niche market, sort of a throwback to the days when maybe they got started this way or the way bikes used to be. But they have dived into the high-tech marketing of bicycles.
Yeah, well, they probably make a bike in about 3 hours, whereas for you it takes about how long?
Well, it depends on the bike, but a typical bike here takes about 10 hours to make and 3 hours to paint.
And that's with the customer coming in first and being fitted?
No, those kind take about 21 hours to make and 8.5 hours to paint. But our basic bikes, which they aren't basic by most standards, but here in this building, they are our basic bikes.
Off-the-shelf bikes.
Yeah. They are the ones that take about 8 to 10 hours to make and a few hours to paint.
So your customers come from, they reach you over the internet, or has that helped, or is it?
No, it's helped. We don't have...
Word of mouth, I guess.
It's word of mouth and the internet. I mean, it's really expensive to advertise. A page in Bicycling Magazine is around $30,000 for a page, and that it's so far out of reach for us that, I mean, it's just a number out there.
And besides, it would be broadcasting to the wrong people for you.
Yeah, it probably would. I mean, I'd like to...
To narrowcast your message, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to be able to afford it to advertise there, and I guess I would like to be able to get our message out to those customers, but it's beyond what I can even think about right now.
All right then, Grant, I really appreciate you being on Bikescape. Thanks for taking the time.
Okay, thanks. Push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Push on a pedal, push on a pedal, get your heart started. Push on a pedal, push it down and up again.
Get on your bike, sit on the seat. Push your feet on the pedal and ride it all around, ride it all around. Get on your bike, sit on the seat. Put your feet on the pedal and ride it all around, ride it all around. Oh, get that car out of my way. I wanna ride my bike today. It keeps me fit, gets me there. I won't go stinking off the air. Leave behind the daily grind. Now let your mind pretend to lie. Better get yourself a bike. Get on your bike, sit on the seat. Put your feet on the pedal and ride it all around, ride it all around. Get on your bike, sit on the seat. Put your feet on the pedal. Ride it all around, ride it all around. Get that car out of my way. I wanna ride my bike today. It keeps me fit, gets me there. I won't go stinking off the air. Leave behind the daily grind. Let your mind unwind. If it's life, pretend to lie. Better get yourself a bike.
All right, well, it's time for the calendar of events. Let's see what's happening in the world of bicycling, at least here in San Francisco. Let's see, the SFBC is playing Cupid on Tuesday, February 6th at the Café du Nord over on Market Street. It's about the 6th annual Love on Wheels party. It's a dating game exclusively for people on bikes. Because, you don't really want to date somebody who drives, do you? You want another cyclist. I mean, don't start off on the wrong foot with a relationship. So if you want to get started out right, go down, check it out. It's happening. You can email love@sfbike.org and tell them how you spin. Now they're asking, boy, 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 girl, girl, girl. Only SFBC members can be contestants. although I'm sure you can probably sign up while you're there. And that is happening February 6th at the Café du Nord. It's $10 for non-members, or free when you join the SFBC. And there doesn't seem to be an address for the Café du Nord, but I'll put a link on the website. What else is going on here? Scrolling through here. Also on Valentine's Day, every year, the SFBC, the Bike Coalition here, shares the love with drivers who share the road. We need volunteers, says their Tube Times calendar, to distribute cards during the day of Valentine's Day. And if you have time during the day, February 14th, think you'd like to help, call up Kate. Kate at SF Bike, I believe, is her address. And I will leave a link for that also. Any of these links that you need are on the blog at bikescape.blogspot.com. And check back if you if the podcast just went up. You may want to come back in a couple of days. And I usually kind of refine the post after a while, but I like to get the podcast up first. Also, let's see, on Sunday, January 21st, pretty soon, if you have a little kid and you'd like to take off the training wheels, well, first I have to ask you, why did you put training wheels on in the first place? I mean, it's just not a good idea. Kids get dependent on them, and then they think that a bike works one way and it doesn't work the other way, because you don't actually turn a bike by turning the handlebars, you turn it by leaning. And you can't learn that with training wheels, so they don't really train you for anything except to be dependent. A good way to train kids to ride a bike, in my opinion, is to take the get one of those third wheel trailer bikes that run back in the back, and the kids learn a lot about how to ride a bike just on one of those. And then when you put them on a real bike, they really get a good have a good feel for it already. But anyway, I digress. There is a Freedom from Training Wheels workshop. It's another supportive session of training wheel liberation. Join the SFBC board member and biking mom Jean Fraser and other families with kids in car-free Golden Gate Park for a group effort to get our kids to ride without training wheels. It's happening this Sunday, January 21st, as I said, from 10:30 to 11:30 on JFK Drive in front of the McLaren Lodge. So bring a bike, helmet, and maybe some snacks to share. And it says here that rain cancels. So you can call Jean. She's got a phone number. It's 415-751-6619. Okay. The Bike Hut. One of these days we'll do an interview over at the Bike Hut. And I owe them a brochure. I've been promising to make a brochure. If anybody wants to go down there and take some pictures, that's what I've been having. That's the big hanging point. That's my excuse for not doing it yet. So if anybody wants to go take some pictures and send them to me for the Bike Hut, that would be great. I'll put a brochure together for Ted. But Ted is from the Bike Hut is trying to get it together to make the Bike Hut bigger and better. And they need some help loading up their new database. So if you know eBase or a FileMaker and you have a couple of evenings to spare doing data entry, they got a couple hundred names and addresses that need to be loaded into the database, so go help Ted out there. What else? Waving Wednesday. We're trying to bring some community back to the city. There was a long time ago when there was a thing called a Waving Wednesday when bicyclists were required to wave at each other when they saw each other on the road. Sort of a community building exercise, and people kind of been sloughing off on that the last few years, so Andy over at the Bike Coalition is trying to bring it back, and you can do that. All you have to do is all day Wednesday you wave at people and then they wave to you and you say, "Hey, pal." Spur, the San Francisco urban planning group, is having a lunchtime talk at 312 Sutter Street at Grant on the fifth floor in their office from 12:30 to 1:30. They're going to talk about Bilbao, the capital of Basque Country, and how it opened a new streetcar line in December 2002, bringing back a mode of transport absent since 1964. A modern transit system now carries about 3 million passengers a year. The principal at Advent Consulting in San Francisco presents, his name is Joss Farron, I believe, presents his new public transport system and discusses its innovations and issues encountered in implementation. So it's free to Spur members and $5 for non-members. Also, along the same line, Tom Radulovich, who's been on our podcast before, is doing a talk Monday, January 22nd on green capitals, walking, cycling, and transit in London, Paris, and Madrid. Join Livable Cities, John Radulovich, for a slideshow on what London, Paris, and Madrid are doing to promote walking, bicycling, and public transit. Urban greening and public space as well. Part of a series of Livable City SFBC events to highlight innovations from around the world. It is free to Livable City and SFBC members, $5 to $10 for non-members, or you can become a member. You can check out the Livable City website, which I'll post, for details and more information. And there is going to be a member meeting. I've been hoping this would happen on Tuesday, January 23rd. The SFBC doesn't have a lot of member meetings these days, but there's going to be, they are looking to the membership to find out what the SFBC's top priorities should be for 2007. And if you want to get involved in an advocacy campaign, or you want to meet other cyclists or other activists, join us at the meeting to meet, greet, and activate. And let's see, what else? Oh, of course, there's Critical Mass, last Friday of the month, meeting at Justin Herman Plaza, also known as Pee Wee Herman Plaza. That's down at the foot of Market Street. 6 o'clock, last Friday of every month, rain or shine, no matter what, it happens. It's been pretty good lately, I think. The last ride was actually excellent, and it was very cohesive. People stuck together, people took responsibility, and it was, above all, great fun. And I really... I'm proud to be involved with Critical Mass again. So it's been that was a great ride. Also, of course, there's Critical Mass in your city, maybe. It's in 200 cities around the world, so check it out. Usually it's on the last Friday of the month. Just came back from LA, where on the second Friday of the month, they have Midnight Riders. And you may want to check out their website. I'll drop a link on the website as well. They meet in different places, and they usually meet around 10 o'clock, and each ride has a theme. And the ride I just went on last Friday when I was down there had to do with, it was called the UFO ride. And I met some people, and don't worry, there will be a podcast about it. It was a great time had by all, and especially me. And I learned a lot, and I got a lot of great interviews, and I met a lot of really great people. And I don't know, people are just really fired up down there in LA. It's just great. All right, so I guess that's the end of the show. I haven't got anything else left to say. But I'm hard at work on some more shows, and keep yourself subscribed and check in every now and then on the blog, bikescape.blogspot.com. Send me emails. I love to hear feedback. I try to respond when I can. It's not always easy. And if you write me asking what that song was by the Australians in the middle of the Push on the Pedal song, I have no idea what it is. If you know, send me an email. Let me know what it is. I just download things willy-nilly, and then I forget what it is. So anyway, what else can I say? Emails can be sent to bikescape@sbcglobal.net. You can leave comments on the blog. You can leave comments privately with me. I'll try to get back to you. And of course, I'm always welcoming of audio files. You send me an audio file, I might just put it on the show. Music, maybe you have a band, you want to play something, should be bike-related, or if you have any kind of audio of like your local Critical Mass or something that's happening, an interview with somebody interesting that you know, send it in. I'll put it on the blog, and I'll send it out as a podcast. So thanks for listening, and don't forget to take the lane. Bye, folks. I am riding by, and
Rocky Day.